listening to WCOM LP 103.5 on your FM dial. This is your community radio. You can reach us on the internet at www.communityradio.coop. Today we're going to continue with a consideration of the mysticism and teachings of Richard of St. Victor. And continue what we did the last time we broached this subject, which was a few weeks back, we basically read the introductory portion of what is known as the Benjamin Miner. Today we are going to cease and desist, as it were, from actually reading too much of the mystic himself, except for a summary at the end, which we'll only read in part also. And we are going to read instead a synopsis of his teachings, taken from the introduction of the Richard and St. Victor volume of the Classics of Western Spirituality. And that was published by Paulus Press and still is in print. The introduction was written by Grover Zinn, Z-I-N-N. And the volume itself was originally published in 1979, which means that it was one of the early published volumes in the series. I'm pretty sure that they have kept it in print, since Richard of St. Victor is a important pillar, as it were, of central teachings of spirituality in Western Christendom. Meaning Catholicism. His writings were extremely influential for many years afterwards. And when read sympathetically, still have a profound significance for anyone who is interested in the spiritual path, not only historically and culturally, but also psychologically. Many of his insights would obtain today for oneself as they would for others. So on that point, what we're going to do is read some of the introductory analytical passages from the introduction to the Richard of St. Victor volume, after which we will pause and then move into the summary portion of the mystical arc, which is the Benjamin major, which deals specifically with the contemplative arts. And that is an appendix which emphasizes the visual architecture of the work. One of the ways that made it probably difficult, perhaps, to follow, and is that what you basically have is you have an elaborate diagram, a visual diagram of how to understand the emotions and the senses and the work of consciousness, and everything is set up in a way which is structurally very intertwined. It's like you're looking at a elaborate maze or a house of many rooms, each character being a room and having unique characteristics. And the static quality to it was really meant to be contemplated in a way which was to give oneself, as it were, guideposts to a terrain which otherwise is an open wilderness, a flux and flow, an open sea of consciousness that waves back and forth and has no bearings. And what we have here, developed through the imagination and from the imagination through the memory, and with the memory and through study and contemplation, slowly this structureless terrain becomes full of possibilities and guideposts, and becomes, as it were, ways of recognizing one's own experience and also guiding one to one's own experience of how it goes. So the starting with a description of the sections that we read a few weeks back, and broadcast is available as a podcast, as this one will be also available under the guise of Richard of St. Victor. We begin with Zen's introduction. In the 12 patriarchs, which is the Benjamin Minor, the successive stages of awareness and discipline, as well as contemplative experience, are presented by Richard via personification allegory, a form of symbolic expression as common in the Middle Ages as it is rare today. The figures for the personifications are drawn from Scripture and are interpreted according to the tropological or moral sense widely used in the medieval biblical interpretation. Two biblical narratives are involved in the personification allegory in the 12 patriarchs. The first is the story of the birth of the 12 sons, the 12 patriarchs, and one daughter to Jacob, his two wives, and their handmaids. The second is the narrative of the disciples' experiences of Jesus' transfiguration. In the first case, Richard takes the sequence of births as the basis for a sequence of stages in discipline and development personified by each of the children. Events associated with each birth, the child's name traditionally a source of deeper meaning, characteristic of a person assigned in the blessing of Jacob, and events of each life provided the material for the tropological interpretation. In the case of the Transfiguration, the experiences of the disciples in climbing the mountain, resting on the top, seeing Jesus transfigured into a being of light, and then falling senseless when they hear the voice of the Father from the luminous cloud, provide the events in the history of the disciples' lives that evoke, by means of symbolic interpretation, certain experiences in the ascetic and contemplative quest. In each case, it is the material of the historical sense that forms the basis for the deeper meaning, a point of view characteristic of Victorine exegesis. Persons, actions, and other circumstances provide the basis for spiritual or symbolic interpretation. Richard's personifications, it should be noted, are not artificial constructions with clothing, facial expressions, demeanor, and actions selected to convey inner characteristics. Demeanor and actions selected to... as are the personifications that are excellent literary examples of Christian personification. None of the interpretations, some of the interpretations may seem forced to the modern reader, but on the whole, the work bears the mark of intent, reflection on the significance of the biblical narrative as a symbolic embodiment of a pattern of discipline and awareness of the self and God that comprises the Christian ascent from fear of God to loving and joyous contemplation. In the figures of Jacob, his wives, and their handmaids, Richard finds an entire epistemology signified. Jacob, the father of the 12 patriarch, represents the rational soul. His two wives represent the principal powers of the soul. Rachel is reason, Leah, affection, which includes will, emotion, and sensibility. Rachel, reason, lends all to all truth. From Leah, affection, comes all virtue. Rachel's handmaid, Bela, signifies imagination, which links reason to the world of the sense perception through the formation of images of things. Leah's handmaid, Zelpha, represents the five bodily senses which connect affection with the external world. In these personifications and their relations, Richard represents his epistemology made vivid with sensible images of persons, and he works out the details of their relation. He etched in basic outline his concepts of the mind and the will in relationship to the self and the world. This effective and pervasive use of personification is only the beginning of what becomes in the end a magnificent tour de force. Richard's characterization of Bela as being like an old man or woman who continues to talk or to tell a story even when no one is listening may not be to everyone's liking, but nevertheless it conveys in a succinct image a truth about the irrepressible nature of imagination and the difficulty of silencing it. Here, Richard draws inspiration from the tradition that saw Leah and Rachel as figures of the active and contemplative lives, respectively. Also, the names of the 12 sons had long been taken to have spiritual meanings, although interpretations differed. Augustine and Gregory the Great formulated the topology of Rachel and Leah for the medieval West, with Leah signifying a active life of engagement with the world and service, preaching, and the like. Rachel signifying the withdrawn life of prayer, asceticism, and contemplation. Richard departs from this usual topology by interpreting the two women not within a dialectic of engagement with and withdrawal from the world, but within a dialectic of the discipline of body and mind as virtues are acquired in one unified life that involves elements of both withdrawal and engagement in community. He draws on the distinction of action and contemplation contained in the writings of the 5th century monastic writer John Cassian, who transmitted many of the basic ideas of the early Egyptian, Palestinian, and Greek monastics to the West. For Cassian, the active life is the pursuit of virtue, leading to an ordered and a recollected life that may or may not involve service to others. The contemplative life is the pursuit of the higher states of spiritual awareness that builds upon the discipline of the active life. It is a sign of Richard's genius that he takes this twofold scheme of active and contemplative, which emerged in the context of the pursuit of the individual perfection, and makes it a scheme for the pursuit of perfection that integrates themes of individuality and community at a profound level. Indeed, for Richard, the most perfect example of active engagement with others in spiritual guidance, pastoral care, and preaching comes not as part of the discipline of the self, but as the result of transformations wrought in contemplation, especially in its ecstatic forms. The reader of the 12 Patriarchs, that is the Benjamin Minor, soon discovers that the grouping of Jacob's children according to the mother's significance for these groups represents successive stages in the contemplative quest. The six children of Leah are virtues that discipline the will, and those of Bela govern thoughts, Zelpha's children control deeds, and Rachel's two offspring, born last respectively, oversee the entire life of asceticism and signify contemplation. It is proper that Leah's six children represent virtues governing the will, for, as Richard says, a virtue is nothing other than a properly ordered and moderated affection. Order is important, for each virtue must be acquired in proper sequence and in relationship to the others. To have hope of God's forgiveness before one possesses true fear of God and grief for sin is to have presumption, not proper hope. Moderation is equally necessary, since a virtue carried to excess becomes a vice. Excessive fear can become despair, unnecessary hope, disillusion, intemperate hatred of vices, and fury. The first four children born to Leah are to be seen as representing a growing awareness of the transcendent world of spiritual reality, the beginning of the moral reform and redirection of individual intention. Reuben, the firstborn, represents fear of God, the recognition of the distance between creator and creature, judge and sinner. Then comes Simeon, represents grief, and Levi, hope of forgiveness. At this point, Richard introduces a number of notions drawn from the 12th century penitential practice. Finally, Judah is born, representing the love of God, the culmination of this initial stage. In a moving and felicitous way, Richard describes this first awakening of love in terms of spiritual friendship, thus drawing on the theme of friendship being revived in the monastic and secular circles of the 12th century, and quoting from chapter 11. From this time on, a kind of intimacy begins to arise between God and the soul, and friendship begins to be established because the soul often feels itself to be visited by God and from his advent, not so much now in to be consoled, but on the contrary, sometimes to be filled with a kind of ineffable joy. The true spouse of the soul is God, who we truly join with us from this time on when we adhere to him through true love. A similar progression from fear through grief to love is found in the first stage of the spiritual journey in You of St. Victor. You of St. Victor, you may remember, was the predecessor of Richard of St. Victor, representing two generations before, making it probable that Richard was inspired by his spiritual mentor in this patterning. Now, an individual has not only been awakened to the world of the Spirit, he or she has begun to long ardently to know God more fully and to love God more deeply. With intention strengthened, one must undertake discipline of imagination and sensation, the handmaids of reason and affection. Only after this can the remaining two children of Leah be born, for they are virtues that represent increasing maturity in the disciplined life of contemplative longing. Imagination, personified by Bela, the handmaid of Rachel, is a very important faculty in Richard's psychology. It is a link between reason and the external world, since it conveys to reason what the bodily senses experience. It is a very vivid way Richard describes how the handmaid is always rushing back and forth between her secluded mistress and the world. Moreover, she does not know when to be quiet or when to leave her mistress alone. Imagination is terribly difficult to silence. Imagination has a second function. As the faculty that presents images to the visible world, it provides the foundation for the knowledge of invisible spiritual truths via similitudes drawn from the visible things. Richard puts it rather bluntly. No one is ignorant that this imagination is the first way of all of those who can enter into contemplation of invisible things, unless perhaps experience has not yet instructed him with the view to the knowledge. Dan, the first son of Bela, represents the literal use of images of the present things to represent other material things, without any hint of the figurate use of symbol here. Richard has particularly in mind the representation of evils of punishment in Gehenna in the eternity, but Dan also represents an especially creative use of visual images in the continual struggle against wandering and illicit thoughts and visualizations. Richard relates that there are certain holy men who, when they experience the tendency of imagination to represent illicit delights and shameful thoughts, even during a time of prayer, immediately visualize the images of future punishment as a counteraction of imagination to banish improper thoughts and the like. Here is a particularly striking passage we find Richard indicating, briefly but pointedly, a useful technique for establishing control of the imagination. It's in chapter 20. Naphtali, the second son, has a name that means comparison, Naphtali. He signifies the use of visible things to represent invisible spiritual truths, especially the goods of eternal life. These representations may be by means of real things used symbolically or by means of fictive things such as golden streets and gates of pearl. Two kinds of representation are distinguished. One is comparison, and the other, translation or conversion. The comparison is a natural phenomenon, such as the brightness of the sun leads to considerations of much greater brightness in the light to be shared by the angels in heaven. Translation or conversion involves the deeper sense of Scripture. That God lives in a light inaccessible leads to the deeper sense that such a light is properly interpreted as the very wisdom of God. In short, by comparison, Richard means something like our use of analogy to describe what the invisible goods of heaven must be, by reference to similar but lesser goods in this world. Conversion or translation, however, is directly related to the spiritual senses of Scripture, allegory, and tropology. And it has a very distinct place in the pursuit of truth. Scripture is unique among books, for it alone has the kind of deeper sense. However, comparison is equally rooted in the Victorian conception of the universe as a kind of book in which there are manifestations of the divine truth. Accessible to the imagination, since they are material realities capable of carrying a deeper sense because of the divine intention, but now obscured by the results of the fall and the weakness of the eye of reason. Rightly ordered and used, however, the imagination can be valuable and essential faculty in service of the pursuit of contemplation. Rather than reject material symbols, Richard finds them to be an important avenue to truth. They are the way in which all persons must begin to think about divine things, and also they offer a symbolic way of speaking about what we must otherwise remain unexpressed and uncommunicated. The next children to be born to Leah are Leah's handmaid Zelpha, and represent the disciplines of the senses. Gad personifies abstinence and Asher patience. The rigorous discipline they introduce results in detachment from both the desires of the worldly pleasure and fears of life's calamities and pains. Their purpose is to establish detachment and distance between the person and the world. In relating to the world, one becomes indifferent to either pleasure or pain. Detachment, not total withdrawal, is the goal. Together with the sons of Bela, Dan and Nephilim, Gad and Asher are called the defenders of the citadel of the soul. This theme of a castle and its defense was destined to become an important motif in later mystical writing. For Richard, the defense must be both internal and external, for there are enemies within as well as without. By proper discipline and detachment, sense experience and imagination becomes a positive support of and not an impediment to the contemplative pursuit. In this process of discipline, the control of the imagination is essential and fundamental. In insisting on the priority of the controlling imagination over that of controlling the body, Richard may seem to reverse much ascetic practice. However, Richard understood the basic role played by imagination and thinking. There must necessarily be a fundamental reordering of thought and inner intention before outer stillness and detachment can be effected. Indeed, outer stillness can be deceptive. In the mystical arc, or the Benjamin Major, Richard points out that there are many persons who cannot be still in their minds, even though they are still in their bodies. Following the birth of the children representing discipline and imagination and sensation, three children represent the last of the seven virtues to be born to Leah. As a group, they personify increasing maturity and disciplined awareness of the self. Ishkakar, the joy of the interior sweetness, is firstborn. That's Isaacar. He represents fleeting experiences of stability and true joy of contemplation. Isaacar lives as an exile, a wanderer. He is almost but not quite detached from the love of the world and almost but not quite ready to enter the state of tranquility of mind and the stability of heart. That is the goal of the discipline. Poised between two worlds, he longs for the fatherland from which he is estranged and to which he is drawn by fervent desire. The effective way in which Richard takes elements of the biblical text related to Ishkakar and makes them the basis of the personification suggests that the personifications may function in two ways. First of all, there is the obviously use of biblical figures to express and relate various states of mind and will, a most valuable way of drawing out the dimension of the spiritual life. There is, however, another side to this. In realizing a particular state, the initiate can view his or her state as being that of the biblical character. The rank beginner becomes Reuben. Fear of God or love of God is born. One is Judah. In beginning of the ascent to knowledge God via the images, one identifies with Naphtali. The list could be lengthened, and we could point to the obvious. Richard has provided archetypes for interpreting experiences, and these archetypes are drawn from the repertory of persons who are significant in the sacred history. The same use can be found in the mystical arc, where Abraham, Moses, Peter, the Queen of Sheba, and others personify and represent symbolically aspects of the spiritual quest and the contemplative experience. Hatred of vices is the sixth virtue, personified by Zabulon, whose name means the dwelling place of fortitude. This virtue concerns not only the self and sin, but also the spiritual nurture of others and a concern for community. In this virtue, Richard reveals a balanced appreciation of the problem of a failure to criticize for fear of disrupting a community of brotherly love, and the equally serious problem of unwanted zeal and misguided harshness in the reproving vices. Above all, hatred of vice is not meant to provide an opportunity for the self-righteous critic who destroys persons through hatred of vice. Criticism must have a restoration as its final end. Furthermore, it must be informed by a commitment to protect the weaker brethren from occasions of failure. Also, the effective critic must be able to take into account individual differences in varying situations. There can be no inflexible standard for all. In addition, one must always recognize that mature contemplatives, as well as beginners, need to be on guard against errors in thought and deed. The degree of advancement is no guarantee of proof against fault. Leah's last child is a daughter, Dina, personifying shame. She receives a more extensive presentation than any other child, indicating that Richard's concern for this virtue. Like the others, shame must be born at a proper time. One can have true shame only after hating vice. It is one thing to be ashamed of being caught and exposed in vice. It is quite another thing to be ashamed of the sin itself. Here, Richard has put bluntly the vast difference between an outward appearance and an inner attitude. He also gives a penetrating analysis of the kinds of things about which one can be ashamed. Ragged clothes, an impoverished moral sense, errors in speaking of or worthless thoughts. We can see here Richard's keen eye for spiritual deceit and false pretenses. No doubt he has hit home with these comments. Two events in Dina's life offer a brilliant representation of the crises of the ascetic self. First, the rape of Dina by Sishum, the love of vain or glory, the son of Elmor, the love of one's own excellence, provides an occasion to consider the dangers of spiritual pride and egotism. Second, the brutal murder of Sichem and his men by Simeon and Levi is the symbolic representation of the inept spiritual guides who impose too harsh a penalty for sin and then make excessive demands on those who have strayed from the path. In both these situations, Richard uses the events in Dina's life as a vivid representation of distortions in discipline. These complex characters contain some of Richard's best and most subtle teachings, underscoring the necessity for insight into the nature of the spiritual quest and the needs of those who pursue it. One literally has matters of life and death in hand, for a misapplication of discipline can lead to a spiritual death and even permanent bodily injury. Two children remain to be born after Dina, Joseph and Benjamin, Rachel's children. Joseph is discretion, or the full self-knowledge. Benjamin personifies contemplation and ecstasy. Both are born of reason, for by it we know both ourselves and God. Rachel's death at the birth of Benjamin is symbolic of a basic truth of the contemplated ecstasy. It transcends all reasoning. Reason is, as it were, dead when ecstasy occurs. Joseph's birth represents the culmination of the discipline through full self-knowledge. He also personifies the ordering and moderation, a function of reason in relation to the virtues. Without discretion, virtues become vices because the disorder or excess. In describing Joseph's relation to other brothers, Richard effects one of the most engaging portraits. The character of the mature ascetic, or the ideal spiritual guide, is sketched briefly, like light pencil lines set down by a master to guide him in bringing a scene of life into vivid color. Fully self-aware, schooled in the dangers of excesses and deficiencies alike, watchful for all the brothers and their individual capacities for action, mindful of deeds of body as well as mind, on guard against destructive demands as well as moral laxity, masquerading as concern for peace. These go a long way towards suggesting the kind of individual inner balance and discreet yet firm direction, Richard expected. The watch over the brothers has a possible double sense. Reason watches over the brothers born of affection, imagination, and the senses to moderate them. The spiritual guide watches over the brothers in the abbey to restrain or to exhort them, as the case may be. One is tempted to see in the latter a reflection of Richard's own role in the life of the abbey. Between the states represented by Joseph and the birth of Benjamin, an important transition takes place. Its most notable characteristic is the beginning of a set of new experiences that are best described as interior visions of the light divinely given. The visions of light have a specific name, Divinia Revelatio, divine showings. We translate Revelatio as showings rather than as the obvious word revelation for a specific reason. The word revelation tends to have many connotations linked with revealed truth or dogmas and with the subjective apprehension of truth described metaphorically as an illumination. Such connotations lead one astray from Richard's use of the word. Showing, emphasizing ideas of manifestation of the unveiling of things otherwise hidden, and a vision, each an important aspect of the Divina showing. The appearance of visions of light is associated with two symbolic images in the 12 patriarchs, the Benjamin Minor. The continual cleansing of the mirror of the soul by Joseph representing discretion, and so discretion here is also a discrimination, and three disciplines who experienced the transfiguration of Jesus. The discretion leads to a state of full self-knowledge with increasing awareness of invisible things of the self. The soul discovers it as a foremost principal mirror for seeing God, as long as we still see by a mirror, and in an enigma we cannot find, as I have said, a mirror more apt for the imaginative vision of him than the rational spirit. This mirror is the image of God according to which human beings have been created, and through continued discipline of the mind, will, and body, the mature ascetic whom Joseph represents continues, and quote from chapter 72, to hold it, the mirror, so that it does not adhere to the earth after it has fallen down by means of love, to wipe it so that it does not become dirty from the dust of useless thoughts, to gaze into it so that the eye of his intentions does not turn towards empty pursuits. Given the nature of medieval mirrors, the image is apt. They were made of polished metal and gave it at best a fuzzy and somewhat dim reflection. Subject to tarnishing, the accumulation of dirt and other vicissitudes in use, they needed careful attention to be useful. So it is with the soul. Only by continual attention to discipline can the mind become still, as it were, and begin to experience a new reality. This vision is not ecstatic contemplation. It is the experience that arouses longing for ecstasy, a longing for the birth of Benjamin. The mention of visions of light brings Richard to a new representation, a mountain. This is not the ordinary mountain. It is the mountain of Jesus' transfiguration. Interpreted tropologically, the transfiguration represents four stages in the experience of ecstatic contemplation. First, the climb up the mountain, a steep way, a secret way, an unknown to many, represents the long period of discipline figured in Jacob's children, Benjamin excluded. Second, the fact that the three disciples, representing work, meditation, and prayer, remain with Jesus on the mountain indicate the stability and repose of true inner peace and quiet, something reached only after a long effort. Richard notes that this inner detachment and radical stillness resulted first only from hard effort, but later become, for some, an almost spontaneous state. One recognizes resonances of Evagrius's apatheia and the purity of heart taught by Cassian. The third stage in Jesus's transfiguration, his manifestation as a being clothed in light. This is tropologically identified with the vision of light mentioned above. Fourth, the disciples fall on the ground senseless when they hear the voice of the Father coming from a brilliant cloud. The fainting of the three disciples represents a failure of sense, memory, and reason in the highest contemplation. The parallel is the patriarchal imagery of the birth of Benjamin, which is accompanied by the death of Rachel, also interpreted as the failure of reason in the experience of contemplative ecstasy. Before leaving or concluding with the 12 patriarchs, we should note again the positive role Richard gives to the visions of light. This sets him apart from authors medieval and modern who either reject visions totally or consider them phenomena that are only peripheral to contemplation. We now see that Richard allows for the occurrences of visionary experience at one of the most crucial junctures in the mystic quest, the transition from the state of internal quiet and recollection to the state of ecstatic contemplation. However, Richard is very cautious in according visions an independent authority. He insists that scripture is the standard by which they must be judged, for even the devil can't transform himself into an angel of light. All heresies and errors come from the subversion of visions by the demonic. It is interesting to note that in the long tradition of mystical experience in Eastern Orthodoxy, the Transfiguration is also identified with visionary experiences of light. It is debatable whether or not Richard had much knowledge of Eastern Christian authors beyond Dionysius, but he did come to stress the aspect of mystical experience that they stressed. Emphasis on the visions of light has certain similarities with phenomena in non-Christian mystical traditions as well. And of which one could look at Vladimir Lasky's The Mystical Theology of the Eastern Church, as well as looking at Monsieur Eliade's The Two and the One, where he emphasizes different non-Christian mysticisms. Further discussion of the nature of contemplation and its relation to visions is reserved for the second of Richard's major works on contemplation, The Mystical Ark, to which we now turn. This is an interpretation of the deeper significance of the Ark of the Covenant, described in Exodus chapter 25. This is also, the Mystical Ark is also known as Benjamin Major. Richard says immediately that he will not offer an allegorical interpretation, since that has been done by others before his time. Instead, he will approach the meaning of the ark tropologically. For a Victorine, this meant finding not only a moral sense in the text, but also in pursuing the significance it has in for the contemplative life. And again, this is the genius of the Richard of St. Victor. This latter is Richard's chief interest. For the reader about to begin the mystical arc, the most useful kind of introductory marks are probably those which point out the specific characteristics of Richard's understanding of the nature of contemplation, the kinds of objects towards which it may be directed, and the modes to which it operates, the ways it is distinguished from the beginning, meditating, and speculation. The reader must also pay good attention to the complex way in which Richard uses the symbolism of the Ark of the Covenant and the two seraphim that accompany it and the inmost chamber of the tabernacle. There are a number of important personifications in the text of this work. Drawn from the biblical text, they represent certain kinds of contemplative experience and function in a way mentioned earlier, namely to provide a concrete example for a particular set of experiences so that the aspiring or actual contemplative may think himself or herself as Abraham, Elijah, the Queen of Sheba, Baziel, or Moses. Finally, biblical texts are incorporated in the text and interpreted tropologically at crucial junctures in Richard's argument. These again provide vivid symbolic representations of aspects of the quest he is describing. Especially effective are the verses drawn from the Song of Songs in books 4 and 5 of the Benjamin Major. For by contemplation, Richard means an attitude of mind, a state of beholding. The mystical arc, he gives the classic definition. Contemplation is the free, more penetrating gaze of the mind, suspended with wonder concerning the manifestations of wisdom. This use of the word contemplatio, although it has much that is special to Richard in its meaning, continues to retain much of the basic meaning of the word, which is an attentive or eager looking at. Above all, it must be clearly understood that contemplation is not some sort of mental process. Richard, like the you of St. Victor before him, is careful to distinguish thinking or rather rambling considerations from many things without purpose, and meditating intent, mental activity concentrated upon one thing or purpose. For the gaining of knowledge from the act of contemplating, the same object may at various times be the object of thinking, meditating, and contemplating. The contemplative act itself is a intent beholding focused upon a single object or cluster of objects presented to the mind by imagination, reason, or the pure understanding that alone has access to divine things. As Richard says, clearly, contemplation always deals with things either manifested or according to their nature, known intimately by study, or made clear by divine showing. The purpose of contemplation is not thinking about something, a rational understanding, ferreting out new truths, or any alike mental operation. It is rather an adhering with wonder to the object that brings it joy. It is non-discursive and unified. It enjoys rather than use it. It rests rather than acts. On that note, I am going to cease our reading and summarize briefly in my own words what we have been reading about. And I'm going to continue for a third show on Richard of St. Victor to round out the Benjamin Major and to read selections of it, particularly from its appendix, which gives the structure of his work to some degree. Needless to say, all of these, this reading is really meant to be introductory. One, I want you to know who Richard of St. Victor is. And those few of you who are interested in pursuing and developing a deeper appreciation to the levels of the contemplative path may find this interesting. If you are of a bent where you practice another tradition, particularly if one practices Tibetan forms of Tibetan Buddhism or Tantric Buddhism, or Vajrayana things, or practice forms of Tantric Hinduism that deals with contemplation, or sadhana that deals with visualizations of the deities in some of the Tantric practices, you will see that there are many junctures where Richard's views are worthy of parallel. And actually deserve, as it were, a closer scrutiny psychologically and metaphorically about how the deeper forms of inner discipline that are used in both the Buddhist and Hindu tantric sadhana gives rise to profound parallels. And to be honest with you, though a superficial comparison, which some of us may be prone to with, if we haven't deeply interiorized these with our own experience, would find that they are, as it were, fundamentally based on our own psychology, even though the presuppositions about a lot of what we're actually doing varies. Some of those variants are seriously worthy of long thought and disciplined inquiry. And I hope in the future to see some scholars address some of these issues. For the most part, the broad outlines have been touched upon, but the profound possibilities of detailed inner work and inner understanding of some of these traditions haven't been touched upon. Again, in summary, Richard of St. Victor represents the beginning, and particularly the spiritual aspects of the synthesis that became in the generations after him of the high scholasticism of Western Christendom. That's Albert Magnus, Thomas Aquinas, Saint Bonaventure. Victor's writings were influential as spiritual manuals for many years within the monastic traditions within Spain and in France, to a lesser extent in Italy. And need to be represented things. I also think that the scholasticism needs to be understood. And also relevant is that the way reason is positioned here creates a difficulty which led generations later to the nominalism that, you know, that sort of took out the soul of Western Christendom and made it more difficult to understand what it was. So, this has again been another edition of Touchstones. I am your host, Paul Nagy, and you are listening to WCOM in Carrboro and Chapel Hill. We are your community radio station. So, thank you for tuning in, and I will see you next week, probably with our concluding consideration of Victor, of Richard of St. Victor.